I'm the president of My Realty Gains. I mean, like everybody else, I have this company. A little bit about myself. Let me jump on to, our core values are accountability, integrity, and transparency. Basically, and we empower our investors. We have complete transparent system with us, in which investors are sort of our partners. Complete transparency. But I don't want to talk too much about that. But let me give you about my background. My background is I have a strong technology and management background for last 25 years. I own certain assets for myself, but for last 5 years I've been doing a lot of deals in GP and JV capacity with other sponsors. We have done one deal in which we have sold as a sponsor also, and we are in the market for new deal right now, and we are always looking for investors and always looking for deals. But in addition to multifamily, we have explored assisted living space also, and we have invested in two projects. We own those two projects basically, and looking for more going forward. I've been a mentor and willing to share knowledge via meetups and social media platforms. We have virtual meetups that, like what we are doing today. And we plan to do more syndications and assisted living deals in future. Today we have E. Katrina and Dylan Marma. And I'll talk about it. E. Katrina first. E. Katrina was born and raised in Moscow. She immigrated to United States 13 years ago. She lives in New York. She's a partner in M2K Partners. They own several mobile home parks communities throughout the country. And what I heard today is they have just signed a contract for about 100 units in Ohio. So congratulations to Ekaterina. Ekaterina is a founder of Equity Tree, co-founder of Equity Tree software platform, which is dedicated to helping commercial real estate investors, manage their deals and investor relations for an affordable price. That's the most important part. And with educational support throughout the entire investment process. She's also a host of virtual meetup for mobile home parks investors called MHP Tribe. Very unique name, MHP Tribe, Mobile Home Park Tribe. Along with him, I have Dylan Marma, a great friend of mine. Both Ekaterina and Dylan both are great friends. And Dylan Marma is a principal of Recuity, the Recuity Group, R Equity. I mean, he said Recuity Group. I got it. Okay, good. And he's a multifamily. I mean, the Recuity Group is a multifamily real estate company, of course. And like me, Dylan has been in the market, but for last 5 years, he has participated in $50 million worth of real estate deals as general partner, or joint venture in joint venture capacity. He wears all the hats, he including acquisitions, investor relations, asset management, business development. He wears all the hats in almost all the deals. He has a passion for scaling the business. Businesses actually, and helping facilitate great deals. He is actually a co-founder along with Ekaterina in Equity Tree. They co-founded this in 2020. And again, this software platform provide a plat this software platform. It's a software solution for investors to become better operators. So this was their introduction. So welcome, guys. Thank you so much again for your time, both of you. Really appreciate that. And take the stage away from us and talk. Share your knowledge with the group.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Prashant. Appreciate the introduction, and appreciate everyone making the time this evening to come and listen to us, and hopefully we can provide some value for you when it comes to improving your business or giving you some insight as to how you can better better fundraise and create an overall just better experience for the investors that are partnering with you on any deals that you're participating in. So just want to say, you know, these kind of groups are, you know, very powerful. I know Prashant and I initially connected back when I was hosting a meetup back in Atlanta, and we met at the Atlanta Multifamily Summit. It was a live event a couple of years back, and we've kept in contact since then. It's been really cool to watch each other grow in the space. And so just no matter what stage you're in right now, it's, you know, it's all about just building the relationships, and it's going to be cool to kind of share the journey with each other. So yeah, as far as the introduction goes, you know, that's, as Prashant mentioned, you know, Kateri and I, you know, built a platform, Equity Tree. She started it probably, you know, I don't want to, probably off, but 18 months back, roughly, right? And then, you know, as she was growing this platform, that was a tool for her business with the joint venture, with her joint venture partners. I was doing, you know, spending enormous amounts of money, you know, for probably 15,000 or more a year on software to manage the syndications and the investors that I was working with, and just saw it to be, you know, a great opportunity for us to build something that's created truly by operators for operators that will serve our unique businesses and also become something that we could share with people of all different levels. So that's sort of the introduction to how that all took place. Kateri, I don't know if you want to add any color to that.
No, I just want to say, you know, Prashant, thank you for having us, and definitely great to be with your group tonight. And what we're going to be sharing, guys, just this is not some, clearly not some theoretical knowledge. Dylan is right now just raised an enormous amount of money for his very first but very beautiful mobile home park community that he's purchasing. And so he's going to share the steps that he is taking from multifamily. They're perfectly transferable to mobile home parks in investing as well. As Prashant kindly mentioned, my team, you know, we just signed the contract. We've been working on this deal for a while, and we're going to go the same exact steps, with the only difference is Dylan is doing the syndication. We, on this particular deal, we're going to be doing a joint venture. And so, but the idea is how you work with investors does not really matter in terms of whether it's within the syndication or joint venture. Investors are, partners are people who you are responsible for and kind of report to and take care of all the same way. So what we're talking about is we live in it every single day. So and we will welcome your questions throughout the presentation. Feel free to jump in, ask, we'll stop and respond. And also this guide, even though it is very thorough, so we will not be able to go through every single detail in it.
Good point. Donovan, did you say something?
No, I'm just putting a few guys on mute.
Got it. Okay. Very good. Well, great stuff. Yes, this is definitely the exact blueprint that you know, we've been following, and it's served us well so far, and plan to have it continue to do so. So let's see. So with that being said, really we look at it as there's five steps when it comes to marketing on a deal. We have your pre-deal marketing, which is by far the most important part. Most of the work gets done before the deal comes up. So I want to really emphasize that as we get into this. But then you have your deal marketing, days 1 through 30. Then you have days 30 to 60, which is the days where your legal documents are probably fully prepared and you're actually getting documents signed, actually getting funds wired to the account. And going through that whole side of the process, which is, you know, where I'm in the middle of today, and Katarina is starting in the deal marketing phase right now. So we're actively experiencing the orange zone there. And then you have your post-close. Post-close is where you build your credibility and, you know, you kind of show that you're ready to execute on your business plan and set the expectations for how the deal is going to go. And Then you got the ongoing asset management, which is again, the I want to emphasize that that's probably the most important part when it comes to maintaining a long-term business, is being able to perform and show up when it comes time to do so. So we like to really emphasize, you kind of came up with the terminology of like more of a farming versus a hunting methodology when it comes to working with your investors, and you're not just kind of, of course, you know, it sounds crazy to even think this, but you know, there are people that are, you know, kind of out there just turning, burning investors, right? And like, they're not following up and doing the reporting they should be, or they're not paying enough attention to the deals and managing the assets as well as they could be. So we like to say the easiest investor you find is a repeat investor, right? The bulk load of investors that I've worked with have came back to invest again. And we've many times we've built just very strong relationships where, you know, we've built friendships around that too. So I think the more you can, you know, perform and also communicate well, the better. So Kateri, anything to hit on that?
No, I think let's just dive right into it.
Go on, yeah. We'll have to cover. So pre-deal, first off, set your goal. The best way to think about your goal is to reverse engineer it, right? So if your goal this year is to buy, say you want to buy $10 million in real estate, or this quarter, this year, whatever it is, right? That being your goal, you realize that maybe your average loan size will make up 70% of the total cost of this property. Maybe it's an 80% loan and you have a bunch of closing costs and CapEx money you're going to raise as well. So you're going to need about 30% of that total cost coming from investors, meaning that you need about $3 million. Average investment size, as you get more experience, I think this number starts to go up a little bit. But from what I've seen, a lot of times the average investment from, you know, limited partners, this is kind of gearing on the syndication side a bit, but you know, it's about 75 grand, right? I would say it's a safe bet. I encourage everyone to make your minimum 50,000. I'm a strong believer of that. I know that there are instances where you may bring someone in for 25, or I know that sometimes groups will start there, but if you're starting to raise millions of dollars and you're early on, I think you can really handicap yourself by going too low on your minimum, because it's going to be a lot of work. Because a lot of people are going to want to test you out. They're going to want to start your minimum, and then they're going to go up with time as they trust you more. So I think an average investment size is 75 grand. And to get to $3 million at 75 grand average investment size, that's 40 investors. That's a lot of people, a ton of people, right? So to get to 40 people that are actually going to commit to that investment, and I've really like, I've looked at these numbers a lot, you know, in my own experience and others. And, you know, you really want to have a list of about 400. About 10% of your list is likely to convert if you have a solid list, right? This isn't a list that you've like just taken from like your old, you know, business emails from people you used to work with or anything like that. This is a list of people that you've legitimately spoken to that have shown interest in investing with you. And then you've added them to the list to be able to view your deals. So about 10% of those people are likely to convert. So yeah, if you want to get 100 investors, you need 1,000 people on your list, right? So that's why it's always important to be doing this work ahead of time. The challenge is that everyone wants to kind of sit back and relax before the deal. And then when the deal comes, they're almost always, you're going to kick yourself for not doing enough before the deal came. So it's all about, you know, doing it when the urgency is not really there, because when you're under the gun and the clock's ticking, you're going to be upset that you didn't do enough. So it's all about getting into those intro phone calls. You know, talking about, you know, I have a list of questions you can read through this, but it's basically just get to know who you're talking to, learn about their goals, learn about what's been their investing experience up to this point. What are they looking for? What would they like to know, right? It's all about just getting into alignment with them and making sure, you know, you want to make sure they align with your investing strategy. More than anything. So certainly encourage that. Yeah, we're not gonna hit on all of these, but these are all other things that go into the pre-deal. You know, you have your elevator pitch, coming up with like a quick way, if you're networking, to describe what it is you do. I wouldn't say to like a complete stranger that doesn't know real estate that I'm in multifamily syndication looking for LPs, because they're just not going to get that. You know, you want to have a way of describing that in layman's terms that makes sense. Having a good company kind of prospectus or credibility book, I think is very helpful. It just shows that you're diligent in forming your investment thesis, and you put time into really outlining why you believe in what you do and how it works. Putting together a sample deal is something we encourage. You know, we run an investor portal software, so the software pretty much facilitates the fundraising process as you bring investors in. And the so we encourage people to have a sample deal within there as investors are getting familiar with the portal and so on. So we push that a lot. And then we have, you know, you're having a basic website. And then, as you know, Prashant was discussing, as people were logging in here, just having a marketing machine of some degree, right? We have to be doing, there's a million ways to market these days, but you got to choose at least, you know, at least probably two or three that you can really get really good at over time that can kind of spread awareness. So that would be the bulk. And then I would, you know, from there, just follow up with monthly emails and keep them engaged, right? Kind of prep them on the asset class, the markets, and so on.
See, the fundamental thing here is the number of people you come in contact with, right, who are willing to invest. And the ratio of who will actually invest with you is so little, you know, it's 10%, you know, Dylan, in your experience, and in my experience also. And those are not the folks who is your ex-colleagues or, you know, friends or family members. These are the like real people who are willing to, who have some money in their pocket and willing to invest. And out, mm-hmm. even out of that, only 10% are going to invest in your deal. So it is a lot of work for maybe for the first one or two deals, but I think it starts rolling, you know, having a snowball effect, you know, as you have more, your list grows, as your number of deals grow, then it becomes easier. You know, first deal is always the hardest.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it always is.
That's my experience. So please continue. Yeah.
Totally agree. So now that you've been doing all this work to build up your investor base, and I pray that you do that work ahead of time so that when this day comes and you have the deal that finally makes sense after you've looked at hundreds of deals and you find one that works, you know, you put it under contract and it's time to get the ball rolling right away. You really can't wait any time to go raise money, or to go like start the process of the raise. So that's why I recommend day one, the day you're under contract, have that deal structuring call with your attorney, right? Which means you're going to probably wire them 10 to 15,000, right? Depending on who, you know, how that works, but that's going to be for the syndication attorney. So you obviously want to know the deal makes sense. If you need a couple of days of due diligence, you can do that. But as soon as you're, you know, even, you know, you're even over the probably 65% sure that you're moving forward with this one, you got to put the risk capital up at work usually to get the attorney on board and get them drafting the documents, because the documents can take time. It can take a few weeks. You're going to have to do revisions, especially your first time around. You want to make sure it reads properly and so on. So you get them starting to draft the documents, you come up with your whole structure. And then as soon as, really for me, what I like to do is share the deal announcement email a little bit after we've done our due diligence. That's when I'm a little bit more certain. I'm like, okay, now we got the docs going, you know, we've been through some physical due diligence. There's probably like an 85% chance, like unless something, we get a curveball that gets thrown our way, we're moving forward on this one. That's when you're announcing the deal usually. And then following up usually about a week to 2 weeks later with the investor memorandum. And if you do this right, this should do a lot of the work for you. You know, if you have a really good investor memorandum that really outlines things. So this requires being extremely diligent. Usually this is like a 20 to 30 page prospectus that will outline every single, you know, nook and cranny of the deal and the details on your business plan, a thorough pro forma showing every line item and showing how your assumptions took place and what you think about the market and why you like it, what the risks are. And most importantly, if you invest $100,000, what's that going to look like over 5 years, right? Making it very, very simple. In addition to being detailed, you also want to pull back and be very simple and high level as to this is what's in it for you and make that very clear to if all this stuff lines up that we're, you know, projecting, this is what's in it for you, right? So you want to usually cater most of the documents to the LP returns and to what's in it for them, because that's what they look for, right? So yeah, but if you do that right, then you're going to place that email and you're going to start getting soft commitments, which are not formal commitments. Usually you can do this on if you have a portal that could do it, you can start up, you know, getting them through the portal. You can use a form. There's a bunch of ways to do it, but you want to start getting soft commitments and tracking the amount of people that are interested and how much they're interested for. And at this point, they have enough details where, you know, if they're putting a soft commitment in after reviewing this, then there's probably a decent chance that they're going to move forward, right? But they will fall out sometimes. We can talk about that, but that's the idea there. Any comments on that, or questions or thoughts?
Yeah, the soft commitment that you take, what in your experience, how much percentage-wise you take the soft commitment? In my experience, I go up to 125% of my raise size, because mm-hmm. when time comes to really give the money, you know, I mean, there are at least 25% of those who are soft committed, they drop off for one reason yep. or another.
Yep. No. So I think that's really fair. I think it's all about how you kind of frame the soft commitment. So if I send it out before I send out any details, then that's a very weak soft commitment, because they didn't really have enough to like make a decision off of. But now yeah. I've kind of transitioned to sending it out with more details. I try to give every single thing out and then give that to them with the soft commitment. So I've kind of shifted my model. So they've become yeah. a lot more accurate of soft commitments. But I think your 125% is probably spot on with what we can all try to target to feel very comfortable on your first go around it. You know, you may want to be extra safe and try to go for 200% or something like that. But over time, I think 125 is a very, you know, very solid target benchmark.
Yeah.
Dylan, this was extremely valuable. I hope to copy and paste this in my life.
There you go. hope you do as well. Let's see. So then from there, it's announcing a webinar. So the soft commitments have been coming in. You have a gauge as to what the level of interest is, and hopefully you feel pretty comfortable. If you don't, you know, you should be making a lot of calls and, you know, doing a lot to, you know, to make sure that everyone's seen it. And then day 25 roughly is the webinar announcement. You might do it a little bit before then, but you announce the webinar. Usually you announce a timeline anyway before this, but then you have a webinar reminder the day of or the day before, and then you host a webinar. And then when you're hosting the webinar, we're not gonna go too into it, but this is more like a highlight, usually 30 minutes to an hour of like a detailed overview of the business plan, the opportunities, the risks, answering frequently asked questions from investors, opening up and letting them interact a bit. So that's kind of the idea. I did say insider secret that some sponsors prefer to pre-record these calls in advance and pre-script questions. I've never done that before, but I'm not saying there's anything wrong with doing that. If you get stage fright, you know, it might be a good idea to do that, especially your first go around, and make sure you have a cleaned up presentation available to everyone. But just an idea. Then you have going into the fundraising section. When it comes to fundraising, you send out the webinar replay link, usually the day after, and call the attendees and kind of get some feedback and see what everyone's thinking, call your soft commitments. At that point, people should be really on the end of the webinar. You're usually directing them into your investor portal, or if you don't have one, some kind of next steps, and getting them to make like a formal offer, and then getting that. And then from there, you're proceeding with the process of sending them the documents, getting them to sign the subscription agreement, agreeing to the docs. And then from there, going into more of the formal, you know, having them wire money to the account pretty much. And then at that point, you know, their spot is saved, so to speak. And as far as that goes, yeah, I have day 32 and day 33. So day 32, day 33, you're you know, depending on how much interest you have, you call the non-attendees, and then you call the non-registered non-attendees if you're really, you know, still kind of coming down to the wire, right? Depending on where you're sitting, right? Hopefully you've done the work beforehand and you're more just guiding everyone to help make the investment and facilitate everything. But on a big raise, I mean, everyone has a certain threshold that they're going to be stretching at. So they need to make sure they're reaching out to everybody. Day 37, send out an email if you have any additional spots left. An email is a great way to get in contact with everyone. And then usually around day 50 or so, sending out an email when the fundraising is complete. You might be way before that, but you might be day 50. You just have to do it, you know, knowing when you're there, but you don't want to, people will get frustrated with you if your deal is fully funded and they're trying to give, you know, basically invest money with you and you tell them there's no room. So you really do want to try to kind of balance that out and, you know, be communicating along the way, so they're not investing all their time into due diligence before placing an offer. And then day 60, sending out an email when the deal is closed. You always want to celebrate that. I would do this more with just the initial investor base, those that are on the deal, and you can kind of go through next steps and get them excited and share in the moment with them. Petter, you want to hit on some of the stuff you do after takeover? I know, you know, you go through a lot of the post-close stuff.
Yep. Just finishing something in the chat here. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as this is, I would say, this is when the real work begins, right? We finally got it to the close. And now this is a perfect time for you to double your investor base, or depending on how well you perform. So this is like, this is your game is on. So this is your time to totally over deliver and make sure that those investors who put their trust in you, bring their friends and family and whoever else, because you just totally are crushing it. And I have to say this, it's not that you are over delivering through all the performance thresholds that you said you're going to do, just executing on your plan, which is always expected. It means that if you said and set out expectations that, okay, guys, we closed, send out email, congrats, the deal is now closed, here is the cadence of our, you know, maybe it's quarterly calls, probably quarterly is the most expected. Well, especially for the first quarter to 6 months, this is when you can make, you know, gain their trust and solidify their commitment and buying into you and your team by communicating on every step that you're taking, really. You want to make them as comfortable as possible by updating them on, you know, this month, you know, here is what transpired on the property. This is what our plan is for the next, for the upcoming months. And this is how we're going to stay on track and going to hit some thresholds. You know, I'm talking about hitting thresholds and doing projects, because, you know, our team, we mostly deal with turnaround projects. So for us, it's action packed on monthly. So, but even if this is not a turnaround project, even if it's a stable property, you want to make sure that you communicate more frequently with your investors, at least at the beginning stages, because this is where when the trust is built. So obviously at the, you know, I definitely like to host a bigger first quarterly call and explain, kind of repeat everything that's being promised at the initial kind of fundraising stage at the webinar. What we do, and that's how the portal initially started, right? Wanted to show partners, investors, how well we are doing, how well we're performing in terms of where we promised we're going to be and where we actually are. So to see those numbers for them, to see whether we're on track or off track, so they don't have to be wondering, because this is what you don't want. You want them to know for a fact. So do whatever you feel is necessary to make them comfortable and take any wondering out of the equation. This is not the time. So that is why I personally like to, even though we have quarterly calls, I personally like to update all information, performance, deal performance information in the portal, which shows the performance and occupancy improvements you know, expenses, all this ratios and all this KPIs in there, and also share, you know, financial reports on monthly basis, especially for the first time when I'm explaining what is happening, what is expected, and so on and so forth. And then on the first quarter, when I also like to record a brief overview of those documents when I'm sending out those reports, I like to just record and explain it, because when they see all these papers coming in, they will have more questions. So you don't want that. You don't want questions or don't want any ambiguity. So I like to just do a quick video recording. It's done, you know, for free. Anyone can do it, and use loom.com. So you can record your screen and your voice, and you actually can go through those financial documents and you can explain your investors. So this is what we're looking at. This is why it's this, and this is how it's improved, and, you know, and so on and so forth. So you can comment. And then you send this all out monthly to your investors. And by the time of your first quarterly call, you just want them to be wowed. You want them to feel like, you know, I absolutely trust you. You know, I see you are keeping me updated. You're doing exactly what you said, what you're going to do, and you're over-delivering. So I think this is absolutely the key. And the best thing right now, I have to say, our quarterly calls, they're like 20-minute calls. I mean, it's 20 minutes just kind of doing the summary, and then we just chat with our partners, simply because everything is very clear. There are no additional questions. They feel informed, they feel on top of things, and because of the tools that we utilize, well, namely the portal, right? They can see in the graphs, and they can see visually, you know, how on track we are from our initial goals. So that's what I would say. And this is when you kind of start planting seeds for future deals, right? Because as Dylan mentioned earlier, there is no better investor than repeat investor. You already have them. They already trusted you once. Now you just have to make sure to maintain this trust, over deliver on it, which is not that complicated. Just schedule these activities in your calendar and stay on top of them, because you are, as a GP, as a principal, you are preparing those reports anyway. So take extra 10 minutes, record the update for your investors, send it out. You don't have to provide them a bunch of financial data. That's not what I'm suggesting. But give them something that they will feel involved. They will feel engaged. They will feel like a part of the deal. And because there is nothing more frustrating for investors that they have to reach out and ask, how is our property doing? Are we on track? Is this happening? I remember we mentioned we're going to be doing submitting or building a new playground. Is this? Are we still on track? There is COVID going on right now. You know, you don't want them wondering. This is the bottom line. Do whatever it takes to stay ahead of any questions and over communicate with your investors. You will not always be perfect. We will not going to be perfect, and things happen, and COVID happens, and other things happen which are beyond our control. The only thing that you are totally responsible for and totally within your power is to communicate with your investors. And this, they will appreciate more than you hitting a very specific threshold this month. So this is kind of my 2 cents on that, because from this investment onward, this is your goal. You want these investors to come with you for your next deal and the next deal after, and you want them to bring their friends and family and so on and so forth. So this is how you farm. So this is your moment of going farming, because you don't want to be out there hunting. But trust me, this is like much easier. If you kind of fertilize the soil the right way, you will never going to be starved. So that's the message. Farm.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, it's fundamentally, you know, it's like taking care of somebody. You know, they are trusting their money to you, and you are holding their hands and taking care of them. And once they build that trust, then they are not going to ask you the questions in the next deal. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, think about it. They are making money, right? Somebody's making money. Somebody has, let's say, $50,000 per year surplus coming in their savings. Where is that money going? I mean, if they have trusted you and you are providing them, giving them the return, think about an investor who is making $50,000, which he wants to invest somewhere, you know, so for life, you know, you have that investor for life.
Yeah, because, you know, even if someone, you know, on the internet comes up and says, well, I can get 2% returns better than they can, they're not going to take the risk on someone else because they've trust you now, right? They've taken the risk on you and you've proven it to work. So why would they try to shift and alter where they're putting their capital?
Yeah, it's like anything, right? I mean, it's like a contracting company, you know, or your landscaper, right? I mean, if your landscaper is working fine, why are you going to go out and look for somebody else?
Yep. Right?
You have every year the same landscaper, he keeps on coming and he keeps on doing the work for you, you know. Every year, the same third-party company where you are hiring the VA from, probably, you'll just hire the same company, you know, all the time. And I mean, unless they mess up. So same thing, investors, yeah, they become your friends, family, they keep continue to invest with you, and you take care of them. Basically, they become part of your family.
Yeah, that's just that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, and I think it's just very important to understand we're not perfect. Things will go wrong sometimes. You just still have to communicate, you know, do the right thing and it's going to be all right. People.
Well, yeah, I think that's a key psychologically. If you're going to be entering the business of managing money and bringing on investor capital, you can't be so attached to the outcome all the time, right? Because like you said, there is going to be curveballs, but you have to be diligent and make the best of the decisions you can with the information that you're given at the current time. And realize that you will have to pivot on the business plan or things will come up, but it's all about how you respond to things that do come up and, you know, how you initially set the expectations and yes, like you said, like the ongoing communication. So I think even just from like a psychological perspective, because sometimes people ask me, you know, how do you deal with like the stress of managing so much money or whatever, right? You know, and it's like, it's a real thing, right? Because if you get so attached to every little, you know, every little up and down or anything, like, I mean, thank God I'm not in the stock market, but you know, there's still going to be setbacks. I say that jokingly, but you know, there's nothing wrong with the stock market, but you know, there's a lot more volatility, highs and lows for people that are managing money in that recently. But yeah, I think, it's about really like understanding like what our role is, right? Our role is to provide the best deals we can find, given the best information we have, you know, make decisions with the information we have in front of us and then communicate well and adjust to that. And I think as long as you do that, you know, you'll end up in a pretty good spot.
Very good.
Mark, I wanted to answer your question, regarding the timeline for closing. Really, I would suggest probably having what I call the target close date, which is usually the earliest close date that you see possible for you to be able to close on, and starting out with what you say your target closes, knowing that that's, you know, you're setting the expectation that is a flexible date. And you're usually collecting the money long before the close date, right? I think one thing that not everyone's familiar with starting off is a lot of people think like, oh, we're just gonna get all the money wired like 2 days before close, but you know, you're gonna lose sleep over that. So I know Prashant's dealt with that firsthand, right? So,
100%.
Yeah, so you wanna make sure you have it wired early as possible. I think, you know, after you go through a few deals, you realize that you're like, okay, I want to get the money wired as soon as possible. You want that in the escrow account, and that's going to allow you to feel, you know, comfortable and focus on the important things as you get closer to close.
And basically investors trust, right? Investors are not giving us the money. Investors are sending the money to the escrow account. And if some investor say, you know, I'm giving you the money 15 days earlier, you can give them 1% return on that money.
Yeah, whatever, that's a good point.
Few bucks, just to make them feel better, you know. Sooner you get the money, better it is for you, right? You have the money in your pocket, you feel comfortable that you are near it. So typically people start anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks before the closing.
No, I like that point you bring up. I have yet to do that. I keep almost forgetting to, but I think it's something I want to do as well, where you give them 1 or 2%. I don't think that can come from the investor money. I think that has to come from
the sponsor. You know, it can come from your acquisition fees, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It has to come from the sponsor, but you know, so it's always something to talk to your attorney about the way to do that properly, but it's a great way to, especially on a big raise or something like that, it's a great way to incentivize people to begin to put some capital up quicker.
Yeah, and there are many times, you know, I have, you know, when I feel like, you know, sometimes people, and you have to decide one way of accepting the money, whether it is wire or a check. And whatever you decide, just stick to that. You know, somebody's doing the ACH, somebody's sending the check. People sometimes, you know, feel pinch of that $25, $30 that they have to spend to wire the money, but just stick to one method of accepting
the money. Yeah, I've always done wiring.
Yeah. Because many times, you know, it's just too much of hassle. You know, where is my money? Why has it not come? ACH is blocked 3 days, you know.
Yep.
Here it goes. So that happens many times. So. Mm-hmm.
So I drive past two abandoned airports every day, and they're for sale. And the broker said that the town wants to put a solar field on it. But I spoke with an equity investor, someone I know in the solar business, and he said that it would be a better deal if it was real estate first with a solar aspect to it. And I don't even know how to approach analyzing the deal and knowing how much it would cost to not only build the units on the land, because it's former airports, so it's just land that's flat. So like, what would you do if you were me? How would you go about figuring out if this is a deal that I should get a contract and wholesale?
I would just start with, I personally would start with a much simpler deal and then do that when you're comfortable with it.
Okay, I respect that. So like a small single family home?
Or just something that already has in place cash flow versus developing on an airport. And it's way too complex for a first deal.
I love that you're all smiling. It makes me feel better. Okay.
No.
Yeah, sorry. I was just joking. No. Let's go by the airport.
Yeah. I love the ambition, though.
But, you know, Ben, this is the thing. You know, if you're looking at the land, you know, one thing is you have a plan. You know, this is what I want to do. You know, and if you have the plan, you can then go and estimate what is going to cost you to bring it to fruition, right? If this is some sort of very specific development you want to do, then, you know, okay, so I want to develop this land for, I don't know, for an apartment complex. I don't know what it could be, right?
One piece of land's for $2.7 million and the other piece of land is for $8 million.
Yeah, so I'm talking about what it's worth to you, right? So it really depends on what's the plan and who is going to be executing it. And I mean, who has the experience and knowledge of executing the plan? So I think it needs to be like a plan first prior to offering any amount of money. I'm just saying this from the standpoint of, again, being a mobile home park investor, and sometimes, well, oftentimes we call owners and they say, well, you see our land, we are on 30 acres of land. It's a premium lot. It's right close to downtown and you should buy it for X million of dollars. I'm saying, well, you see, I'm not a developer, so I wouldn't know what to do with 30 acres. I'm curious to know how many developed lots you have in the park that I can actually use right now, because I'm a mobile home park operator. So I only care about that. And if you tell me you have on 30 acres, let's say 200 lots developed, and you have 10 acres that are undeveloped, then I would estimate what it will cost me to develop additional lots on those 10 acres. But until I have like a plan, and I wouldn't know what to offer them. I'm not a redeveloper, so it really depends on the plan.
It is a business, right? I mean, you are buying an airport. It's a complicated business in itself. You will build a building, and then somebody has to bring the planes there for you to get the rent for that. You know, you're talking about the whole business. You know,
completely
you're
not different talking, animal here.
It's a different business altogether. And trust us, you know, there are bigger fishes in the pond, you know, who are already looking at that. Then at least me, you know, I cannot talk about you, but there are definitely many bigger people who have more experience in that industry.
So that was one thing that I learned as well, at least early on. I guess I formed the belief system that to get good returns, first of all, you don't always want to be getting the best return. Like, I think I'm a big follower of like Howard Marks. He runs a distressed debt fund, but he talks a lot about like his investment thesis is a lot of like, you don't always want to be shooting for the grand slams all the time, because the one that's always at the top during a good market is usually all the way at the bottom during a bad market, right? So you really want to be shooting for a lot of doubles. I think that's what this business is about, is consistent doubles, you know, time and time again. And I think I learned early on that especially a lot of people that come in from like single family flipping or something like that into commercial, they want to go after these like really attractive development deals or like heavy, heavy repositions. But you can get so many deals that have great returns just by continuing to look at enough deals that you're not taking on extraordinary amounts of risk before you have the experience to execute on a more opportunistic business plan.
Nice, that was really helpful. So if I'm going to focus on a really simple deal, should I do it in my backyard in Long Island where houses are expensive, or should I go to Austin, Boise, Denver, or Seattle where the demographics are growing?
Well, let's think about it. What is your goal? Do you plan to work with investors?
Ideally, I would raise money because I don't have much.
Okay. So ideally you would raise, so if you're working with investor capital, then I'm a believer that it helps to be in a market that is attractive towards investor capital. I think that's why, while Prashant lives in Long Island, you're not looking at a lot of big deals, raising a lot of money for Long Island, right? He's looking elsewhere. And I think a lot of people are.
See, Long Island is not a market where you would buy multifamily deal. I mean, even if you buy it, you will buy it at a very low cap rate, because you would look for appreciation then really a cash flow kind of a deal here. Mm-hmm. And there are not many properties for sale here anyway, to begin with.
I mean, mm-hmm. They're all 5% cap rate, and all the YouTube videos say I should focus on 10% cap rate, meaning I have to focus on Texas and I can't even invest in my own backyard, which would be easier for me.
No, you can invest in your backyard in a different asset class then, right? I mean, you don't have to invest in multifamily, because Long Island is not made for multifamily investing. I know at least 10 syndicators here in Long Island who do not invest in Long Island.
I love watching. You guys have your own podcast, you three. You guys are great. I've learned so much from hopping on this call. Amazing. Seriously.
What do investors think of North Bronx? And, you know, Brendan brought up a good point too. There's opportunity anywhere. There's just different types of opportunity, right? Like, we're not saying that you're going to do bad if you buy in North Bronx, right? Just would one of us raise a lot of money for the North Bronx? Probably not, because that's just not our business strategy. But I know there are developers and people buying real estate in New York that, you know, New York City that do tremendous, right? You just really need to pick a niche though, and pick a lane as far as, you know, where you want to focus your efforts and expertise.
See, listen, I will give you one example, okay? And I don't mean to cut you off. When you open your eyes and you move around your eyes, you know, you go outside your house, what do you see? You see real estate. Wherever you go, you see the real estate. Your product is everywhere. Your home, next door home, you know, next town, next state, next city, New York. So there will always be an opportunity. There will always be buy and sell of real estate wherever you go. It is up to you to decide what you want to do. Would there be people doing the transaction in non-Bronx? Yes, 100%. Those who know that market well, they would do that. I mean, I don't know North Bronx that much, that well, so I don't dare.
I'm here in the Bronx, so.
Okay, here you go. Katrina is there already. So, so this is an abundant product, right? You don't have to create it. It is always there for you. That's why we are in real estate. You don't have to manufacture it. It all you have to do is you have to transform it in a different form. If it is a land, you have to have a building. If it is a building, you just have to refurbish it, renovate it, put a different color, improve the valuation. So there are product out there already. And will never disappear. It will always be there, you know, like currency, you know, it will always be there for you. So that's why, you know, I mean, that's my motivation speech about real estate. That's why I'm in real estate, you know.
Love it.
Guys, Dylan, thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. Katrina, thank you so much again.
Very welcome.
Yes.
Thank you.
No, pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your knowledge with the group.
Yeah, great conversation.
For everybody else, you know, very, very good guys. Thank you so much for listening to us, you know.
Thank you. Have a good night.
We'll be in touch again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.